Blog Talk Radio.
Drugs and rock and roll. This is Reconstructs Live. I am Mike Sledge. We're live right here on the one and only Renegade Broadcasting, renegadebroadcasting.com. The channel for where white people can be white. The channel where nationalists can talk about nationalism. The network that sees through the religious indoctrination and the fake morality of the enemy to keep us trapped in an intellectual lockbox so we can't break free of the programming and bring down their system of fear, propaganda, and control. And we got a big show tonight, because this broadcast tonight, my guest will be Siegfried. He is right here as well at Renegade Broadcasting with Ragnarok Now every Friday. Great show. We've done shows in the past, and we did a 60s show together. And I figured that, you know, we were talking about doing another 60s show, and I said, hey, no, let's do a 70s show, because the 70s, you know, I feel like this. You know, we covered in the last show that Siegfried and I did on the 60s, we decided that we need to move forward into the 70s, because so many researchers and people that study history like to separate the decades, like the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s now. And really, ever since the end of World War II, and particularly beginning with the McCarthy hearings, the blacklist era, we see this constant struggle between America Firsters, nationalists, people who stood up against the multicultural programming, people who stood up against the feminist and gay agenda, people that stood up against the Bolshevik Jewish communism that had began to devour this country like a cancer. And we see the battle lines being drawn going back to the McCarthy hearings and the blacklist days. And really from there, starting with the beatniks, Kerouac and those people, the Jew beatniks, Ginsburg, homosexual Jew there, and the filth that he proclaimed. We see that moving into the 60s with the British invasion, and that's very important to understand, the British invasion, because, you know, this was symbolic of using a counterculture to destroy the family structure, to destroy institutions, and charge the institutions as being guilty rather than charge the individuals that had infiltrated the institutions as being the guilty party. And we see this program taking hold in the 60s. And our 60s show, I would recommend to go back in the archives for those listening that haven't heard it, to listen to that. Also listen to my old broadcast on Chicago, the Chicago School, the beginning of the end, because that ties in to the 60s show that Siegfried and I did. It gets into the Chicago Convention of 68, the Yippies, the Jewish Yippies, Abby Hoffman, and then and that kind of set the stage for Woodstock. But then what we're going to get into tonight is very interesting, because from the beginning of the 70s, right when the 70s began, what do we see happen? Two events. We saw the Manson family hearings, the Manson family trial, okay, which you could say really was used as a show trial to demonize National Socialism. All of a sudden you saw this crazed acid head with a swastika cut into his forehead standing on trial in front of the whole country. And they used the opportunity of that show trial, the Manson family, at the beginning of the 70s to then not only discredit the rising counterculture that was now emerging on the scene in the early 70s and late 60s with groups like Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, the backlash to the peace, love, communist, Bolshevik, hippie movement. You began to see a art arising, a music arising that was really going back in many ways to what we talk about on this network, was going back to European spiritualism. In the case of Led Zeppelin, also in the case of Black Sabbath, Odinism, Druids, all these kind of concepts begin to come out into the forefront as kind of a backlash against that original concept, so they had to discredit it. And in many ways, I believe that the Manson family show trial was the beginning of that discrediting of the opposition to the original communist multicultural programming. And that is why the show tonight, we're going to go into disco, because I believe that disco was used to destroy and undermine the backlash music against the 60s and the early 70s, mainly what I call the German invasion of groups like Can and Kraftwerk coming out of Germany. And we're going to get into all that. And let me go ahead and bring Siegfried on. Siegfried! Welcome back.
Hello. Hello, Mike. Thank you for having me yet again. This is a great idea to do the 70s show. I just want to say real quick, since the culling of the Truth Militia channel on Blog Talk, people are going to have a hard time finding it, so I'll get Kyle to upload that old show from back in March or whatever when we did it. So that'll be... That should be up on Renegade soon enough. I'll get Kyle to do that. So yeah, people can check that out because I thought that was a great one. Everything you were saying, I was just now just summing up the decade and I was just nodding my head, just in agreement. I mean, spot on. The thing about decade construction, you know, I mean, it could be as mundane of a endeavor as to prepare the future consumers to buy the, you know, Halloween costumes that are themed from a decade or the CD sets, you know.
Right.
I mean, they make everything into a commodity, into a consumer item, and that's and at the same time, psychologically satiating and pleasing people who were from that era. I mean, you go into a grocery store, what do they play? They play all this baby boomer 60s music. And that's an effort to sort of lull the consumer's mind to sleep, give them memories that they'll cherish and perhaps have good memories of, and these songs spur that off. And I know that, and I could say the same about myself. I hear a certain song, I'll feel a certain way and remember a certain time in my past. And I mean, all that music is tied in with a time period in American history where people experience new things, mm-hmm. so those memories will be fresh in their minds forever. And just the fact that, you know, hippiedom became cultural dogma of obviously the decade right after the 70s, and then after that too. I mean, not just legally speaking, not just culturally speaking. I mean, just for the people who lived it, they will stay in their memories, and it will be there to be exploited later by Jew businesses trying to sell a bunch of consumer crap.
Yeah, and let me just say this. I'm going to bring you back in a couple weeks to do the 80s show.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then we're going to do the 90s show together. And
I got to be on that one. That's,
yeah,
I actually lived through the 90s.
Yeah, and we're going to do all of these decades, because all the way to now in the current truth movement, because
yeah,
it all fits together perfectly. And let me say, mm-hmm. the some of the topics we'll be discussing tonight that I put in the information there, little paragraph there of the show tonight,
yeah.
We will be getting into the connection between disco and how it actually originated in France by French Jews when Germany actually was in control of France, and they had underground discotheques where they had homosexual parties, communist parties in the discotheques, and they were used as communist centers to plot on how to get rid of Germans, okay, within the country at that time in the early 40s. And you can trace this history back, and that's very interesting, because you're going to see how really beginning in 74 with the emergence of American disco, it was all controlled completely by Jewish record execs who wanted to sell trends as the television got more popular, but also mm-hmm. to undermine and destroy the emerging backlash music against the peace and love people, and really the music that was getting into more of an esoteric European nature. And we kind of can get into that tonight. And that also connects, we'll get into the topic of Robert Anton Wilson and the Illuminatus trilogy, which came out in 76, which I find very interesting. And that connects because I have some connections here and some things I've pieced together that I figured we could have a discussion on that I think really are interesting and really show you how basically the 70s and the disco movement really paved the way not only for commercialized communism, that's what I call it, TV communism, okay, consumerist communism, consumerist Bolshevism, through music, which set the stage for modern MTV today, but also it also paved the way for Ronald Reagan to become president, okay? And this is very interesting as we get into the 80s on another show. But let's get into the topic at hand. The early 70s, I figured we could start there. You know, I mentioned the Manson family, and that trial really did a great job that show trial is what it was. And I would recommend reading some of the books written by Adam Gorightly on the Manson family. I think they're pretty good. I don't agree with his point of view and everything, but I think he uncovered some things there that are pretty interesting. You really see the connections between Manson and the Hollywood elite. The Beach Boys, he actually stayed with the drummer of the Beach Boys. They lived together. He actually lived in Laurel Canyon across the street from Mama Cass, okay, from the Mamas and the Papas. He actually tried out to be one of the monkeys in the TV show, okay? So this was not just some bum who did not have any connections to the Jewish-run Hollywood elite. He had plenty of connections into that whole deal there. And what do we see happening with the Manson family, Sig, at the beginning of the 70s is, you know, Helter Skelter, they used both Altamont and the Manson family show trial to really discredit the counterculture at that time, because those mm-hmm. communist Jews that have led the counterculture in the 60s had already consolidated their power, okay? They had already entered into the arena and consolidated their power, and they didn't want to let the new breed that was on the rise to come in a new counterculture.
Right.
Okay? And so they had to destroy it and dismantle it at that time, okay? So what are your thoughts on that as we start out here with the early 70s?
Well, I mean, it's just typical of them. I mean, and let me just go back to the disco origins for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I was about to say, oh, wow, that's unbelievable. But, you know, it's not unbelievable for a bunch of homosexual Jews in France to end up influencing the culture of America. What they do is they like to give you maybe a piece of what would be preferable for your people, that's going towards more like the Led Zeppelin type of stuff. I mean, in terms of native European esotericism, you know, but they toy with these things all the time, and they shift things in a sense that would benefit their ownership and whatever cultural niche they're already within, whatever trend they are already in, they're going to gear the whole world towards as much as they can. And they were very effective at doing that even back then. And today, I mean, it's even more globalized, so it's next to impossible not to find them in all crevices of cultural changes. So it comes to no surprise to me that's the case, what was going on back in the early 70s with the Manson trial and all that.
Yeah, and also beginning in 69 and 70, we saw the emergence of krautrock. The krautrock revolution from Germany, Can, Kraftwerk, Octopus,
yeah.
Others, and they were rising rapidly, and there was even talk. We had the British invasion with Beatles and the Tavistock kind of programming that basically was a modern-day Frankfurt School for the 60s, pushing the agenda of cultural Marxism. But what we saw with the German krautrock scene was totally different. It was a futuristic modernist scene,
yes,
that was totally different. And what was their signature? Their signature was the use of new technology, new synthesizer sounds that were light years ahead of the music that was coming out. And what happened? The krautrock revolution out of Germany basically had to be quarantined. We see the
exactly. That's
yeah, exactly.
Great way to put it. Great way to put it. Go ahead.
Because they could not allow. The German invasion to take place, because music is one of the most powerful tools that we have in changing cultural trends and cultural mindsets. And these Jews who controlled the American record industry and the English record industry, the record industry, were scared to death of this German invasion. And so what do? They commercialized the new technology and created disco.
Right. Absolutely. There's a lot more bands you didn't even mention.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think they're actually British, but they were out of Germany. They were called Nektar.
Yes, yes.
And
uh-huh.
And also Amandul, arguably, I guess, is krautrock too. Yeah, but absolutely correct. If there's something cultural that's threatening, they'll let it go for a sec, but then they'll galvanize all their forces to either mimic it or buy them out. And that's all they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, yeah, and for something to be at those, the records they were coming out with in the early 70s alone were, I mean, today people won't be so impressed with them. I mean, because you can, you buy a freaking Mac and you can create the very same noises with no trouble at all. It's like nothing now. But back then they were trailblazers. They knew it. They knew they were creating new sounds, and they had fans all over the world who wanted it more and more. And so, you know, the Jews see that and they see money. So they needed to go where the money was. So they did their best to at least take it over, you know?
Yeah, absolutely they did. And then at the same time as the German invasion, and that's what I call it, the German invasion was taking place, we see that you had bands like Led Zeppelin, you had Black Sabbath, you had other bands during that time, the early 70s, what you would call acid rock or early metal, promoting the ideas of European roots, man.
Mm-hmm.
They were going back into old, ancient European spiritualism in their music, and that also they did not like, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I plan on doing a Led Zeppelin show, by the way, to show how that was undermined, actually, by Peter Grant in some ways, because you'll find that on their first album their first three albums, there were many songs that they originally claimed were theirs that really weren't. They were actually written.
Oh, yes. Well, one of them is Spirit. Oh, no, that's in the fourth album.
Exactly. And that's important, the song by Spirit that they ripped off, okay? Because Spirit was a real occult band, okay, that did not get much play out of California, I believe.
Yeah, they had a guy named John Locke playing keyboards.
Yes. And they were actually into, if you look at their album cover, it's pretty amazing for their...
Yes, it is.
Okay, it is basically what we talk about on this network. Okay? And so what I see in Led Zeppelin even was they siphoned off the creativity from some of the underground emerging bands like Spirit and took that occult concept, commercialized it, and then funneled the money back into the Jewish system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty amazing. And for those that are listening that have never heard the band Spirit, please check out.
Please.
Check out their music. It is absolutely mind-blowing, and they never get any credit at all.
Never. And never any airtime or anything. I mean, they have one song. It must be off of the third album or something like that, fourth album, I'm not sure. But it's called 1984. That's just one song. I mean, yeah, it's just they were very skilled, perfect personnel set up, at least in my opinion. That's totally unknown today. That's they're a 60s, early 70s sort of outfit, and I mean, they're along with I don't know, like the Small Faces or something else, like late mid 60s that just no one even knows about. I mean, back then they'd be, you know, relatively famous. They just dissipated in fame completely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not even just because of they broke up or one of them died. It's beyond that, in my opinion. The reason why they disappeared in terms of popularity, yeah, even though, despite their obvious talent, you know.
Yeah, so what we see here, and I totally agree with you, man, what we really saw there was the beginning of basically, you know, if you allow, kind of the freedom and creativity to emerge that wants to delve deep into some of the esoteric and those kind of issues, you will have some interesting art being created. And it is clear that any time you have, even if it's controlled and set up by the enemy, but still allows for people to have access to tools that can create new art or new music, you will have stuff created that will be good stuff. And that's what happened then. And the same thing we see even with the controlled truth movement today. We see that there has been a lot of good things created from this as well. It's just it's always a game with them. Even when they create the agenda, they still have to watch over it and make sure that no one breaks out of the cage that they've set up. You can only go so far, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And, I mean, today, arguably, maybe they have the most influence and power. But, I mean, it doesn't seem that way because they really can't handle all the people waking up simultaneously and forming their own opinions and ditching the churches. And I mean, those are just a few things that are going on today. But, you know, back in the 70s, it was a little harder for them.
Yeah.
For them to watch the trends and really set them. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that brings us to, and we saw this from 69, but really 70 to 74. And then in 74, we see the beginning of the Jewish record monopolies really bringing out disco in full gear.
Mm-hmm.
And the history of disco is this, and I'll go over it one more time because I think this is important.
Go ahead.
Disco actually comes from the French concept of discotheques, which sprang up in the early 40s, from 1940 to like 42, 43, when Germany was in France, okay? And these were disgruntled people who did not like Germans, and they were mostly communist. Many of them were homosexuals. Many of them were early Jewish women who were leaders in the feminist movement that then spread into this country in the 60s. And they created what was called discotheques, and they were underground places where they basically played pop jazz, if you will, at that time, hooky jazz. And it was very multicultural. It was very communist. They had a lot of communist meetings in the discotheques at the time. Now, that's very interesting to understand because what we see happening in 74 when the Jews decided to bring out disco based upon the concept from France by the French communists there. They brought in the concept of disco, and also, this is very important to understand, disco actually, according to gay rights activists, disco also stood for not only discotheque, but disco, to disconnect from the mainstream. Okay, to become disconnected from the nuclear family, to become disconnected from regular sexual activity,
mm-hmm.
and become more involved in the underground homosexual movement. And you can see this begin to take place, particularly when you look at John Frankenheimer's movie Cruising with Al Pacino. Forget Scarface, okay? This is one of the most disgusting movies ever made, but it really showed you how the discotheques, the underground discotheques in New York City, were connected connected directly, okay, to the homosexual agenda as well as the communist agenda. Because in that movie Cruising, you will see when Al Pacino is one of the discotheques dancing there, doing annual nitro poppers with his gay lover.
Oh God!
There's a communist hammer and sickle flag in the background. Okay.
Of course there is.
Yeah.
I haven't seen one. You're still talking about Cruising. I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
I don't think I want to now, but.
But so they came out with this, and also it served a dual purpose, as I said. They had to destroy, the synthesizer German music that was coming out that was very creative and very, it was not commercial at all. But they took the synthesizer sound of the German movement in the early 70s and then transferred it into the disco. And then they used it for commercialism and to push the multicultural gay agenda in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll take technology, take technology and use it against you. I mean, look at Soviet Union using its technology, the German tank technology against them, something like that. Now I'm going back to the freaking 40s, but you know, I'm sorry. this is standard for them.
It is, and okay. There's a guy in the chat room. Okay, obsessed with spirit being kikes. Okay, I don't know if they were or not, but who cares?
Well, I know.
Are you going to spend the next hour and a half talking about how spirit is kikes? Who cares? Randy, we're talking about creativity and sound.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, man.
I mean, yeah, it's just sad to see. Who was it? Yeah, someone just posted a video too in the chat room. Is it Robert Moog?
Yes, oh, the Moog. Yep.
Yeah. We have these amazing technologies. Again, we have the creators, the innovators, Germanics, creating this technology, and then how does it get squandered? I mean, 40 years down the line, we're stuck with Skrillex. Like, it's just like, yeah, unbelievable what this technology actually leads up to. But it's amazing what you yield and can see it helping to create at the dawning of its release. You know, when it gets out there and real musicians can get their hands on it and use it. It's incredible, and we have that immortalized in, you know, those couple of records before the disco insanity infiltrated, and, you know, the record companies may have or did not perhaps pressure certain bands to change their sound to sell better because of the disco fever that the whole world had, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And here's what's also interesting. You mentioned the Moog. Well, guess what? The Moog has a Georgia connection. I believe the only place that the Moog is still created and made is actually in Duluth, Georgia, I believe, which is a suburb of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the Moog. Have you ever heard of Dick Hyman?
No.
Okay, now, the name might sound funny. That was programmed by he was a Jew. And for those that listen to a lot of Celtic Rebel shows, I'm sure Dick Hyman, oh my God. Let's talk about fucking butt sex for 2 hours now.
Yeah.
But Dick Hyman, actually the music was good. And he was really a forerunner of the Moog sound. I would tell everybody to check out some of his early music. And look, I might mention some people who might be Jewish, who might not be Jewish in the music business, whatever. I'm only, from musical taste, I like what I hear. You know what I mean? So
oh, yeah.
That's the way it is. But it's good stuff. But yeah, I do believe it's Duluth, Georgia. The Moog is still, you know. But, you know, check it out, Dick Hyman.
I will.
It kind of sounds like somebody. I think he did some of the Moog synthesizer for Gilligan's Island episodes.
Oh wow! I'm sure. HR Puff and stuff had some Moog moments in its soundtrack too. So maybe he was responsible for that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a trippy show. It needed something.
HR Puff and stuff. HR Puff and stuff. Only that could be in the 70s.
Yeah, right.
HR. Hey, you know what's funny? All these kids are worried about, you know, well, now it's, you know, it's Barney. Well, that was the 90s, but
yeah.
HR Puff and stuff.
Yeah.
Sounds God. Pretty good to me.
Yeah, it's pretty much the most surreal, psychedelic live action thing I've ever seen in my life. And it was a kid's show. Unbelievable.
Yeah, the guy kind of looked like a the puppet thing there kind of looked like a huge giant toad on acid.
Right. Yeah, and, his eyes were like drippy with like red. Something is weird.
It should have been called, well, you know, they tried to make a sequel to that in the 80s. Maybe we can do this in the 80s show. In the 70s, it was HR Puff and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, it was HR. It was a Leroy Puff and Crack. And he had like an afro, and he looked like an acid toad, and he was hanging out listening to Public Enemy.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, man, come on, give me a rock, brother. Help a brother out. Give me a rock, man. We can do that in our 80s show, man.
Absolutely. Have to. It's going to be hard picking out music for that show. Wow.
Now, kind of going back here to the early 70s thing, I want to cover one more thing that I forgot about, which I find interesting. Now, remember we did our 60 show, we went to Abbie Hoffman and the Yippies, right?
Sure.
And that actually, the Chicago 68 convention really consolidated the Jewish syndicate's Chicago power. And basically from that point on, they began to run through the Chicago school, the political arena, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people like to talk about New York City, and yes, it is true. But there's a different breed of Jewish control coming out of Chicago. It's a little different from the New York City school of Jewish ideology. It is not, I would say, even though New York City is a very liberal city, I would say that the Jewish power pockets there are very orthodox, Likudish, and right-wing, okay?
Right.
And I think the Chicago school would be more of your Rothschildian, your Rothschild, liberal, atheistic type of a Jewish grid. And we see Abbie Hoffman really pushing the why don't we do it in the road mentality, the free sex, also the multicultural programming, as he brought the Black Panthers into the 68 convention to be on the stage.
Wow.
With them. And that goes back to MC5, the band MC5, who did that at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about that is that we see that expanding, and what came out. There was actually a journalist that actually became very popular writing for Rolling Stone magazine because of his article on the 68 Chicago convention, and that was Hunter S. Thompson. Okay? And the reason I bring him up is because one of his first books that he wrote was The Hell's Angels, which I believe came out in 67 or 68.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Okay?
Because Fear and Loathing came out like 72 or 71.
Yeah, that came out in 71, and we're going to get into that, how that connects to this.
Okay.
Which I find very interesting, and how that connects to Robert Anton Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
But we see he came out with the Hell's Angels book. If you read that book, and I have, and it's a very good book. He's a great writer. He was a wordsmith. He was a very good writer, whether you agree or disagree. I think he's an interesting character. I actually agree with much of what he wrote on many issues. Okay? I will not back down from that, particularly on guns and his support for the Second Amendment, which I think sets him a little different from the rest of those people in that decade.
Oh, yeah.
But absolutely. Nevertheless, when he came out with the Hell's Angels, what was interesting about that book was he kind of combined the concept of the Hell's Angels with Hitler and the Nazi Party, or the NSDAP Party, but he called it Nazi Party in the book. And basically, it began the concept of how the Hell's Angels were basically like modern-day Nazis. Okay, even though the Hell's Angels were created beginning in New York by Sonny Barger, a Jew.
Wow.
And it was actually a Jewish syndicate-created organization, oftentimes wearing Nazi regalia, but actually it was created to run drugs for the syndicate. A lot of people don't know that. But it began the association with Hell's Angels and Nazis. And then when Altamont happened in the early 70s, right? It was the antithesis to Woodstock, right?
Yeah.
We see Altamont occurring. And what the association was already made. And Altamont occurred when the Hell's Angels killed someone during the concert, stabbed a black guy to death during the concert, while the song Sympathy for the Devil was playing by the Rolling Stones. Come on now.
Oh, I thought it was Give Me Shelter, actually. But
oh, was it Give Me Shelter? Okay.
It was one of those two.
Okay.
I think you're right, but I thought I heard Give Me Shelter. It's one of those two. I mean, either of them.
Yeah. So it was one of those, but it was at Altamont. Okay, so you had this whole thing now, and then that repopularized the Hell's Angels book. And also, this was going on at the same time the Manson trials were taking place. So here we see early on in the decade, there is, I mean, in my opinion, I might be connecting too many dots here and maybe coming up with my own theory, but even if it is, so be it. It turned out that whether it was orchestrated or not, it became a media frenzy, once again demonizing Germany, demonizing the concept of National Socialism and the New Right in this country.
Yes, and let me just say, I noticed that back in the day, and looking back at these decades, as someone born in the 90s, those things just came naturally to me because I saw how things were merely constructed, and just to see the world events like Altamont and the trials going on at the same time, I saw the connections there, but you know, back when I first learned about this stuff, I didn't make the Jewish connections because, you know, I just couldn't accept it psychologically in my mind. But nowadays, I mean, I look at and it's just so obvious that, I mean, they want all these things coalesced and toyed with, and it really galvanized into a amorphous blob of hate and evil so they can satiate the people who want it with their own forms of it later on, and log in whoever's reading about it on the internet later, and when the internet's given to the people, you know, it's just insane how these decades to me just seem so constructed. And I'm so glad you brought up the fact that those two events were so close to each other, because Altamont is an important one when we're looking at this type of stuff.
And also later on in the broadcast tonight, Sig, I actually have I'm going to get back into the Skokie situation, how Frank Cohen actually ties in with the demonization that we're talking about now in the early 70s in 1977 with the Skokie incident, okay, and how that's important, okay,
yeah.
And how that ties in. Because there was this theme, this constant thread of refighting, and also the Nixon impeachment, okay?
Yep.
Of refighting, that basically the battle never ended from World War II, and it's still going on today. But it's veiled, and only those that understand history and the esoteric would understand really how this all connects, in my opinion. But it does, and it connects very well. But here we see, you know, that taking place. The Hell's Angels book comes back on the scene. Then we see Watergate occurring, the Manson family trials, Altamont, all of this occurring at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The German music scene was rising up.
Yep. Exactly.
The same time the German scene was rising up. And then covered the disco and where that came from. Now, let's get into an interesting character here that I find very interesting that connects directly to McCarthy hearings, the blacklist decade time there, the hearings there in the late 50s, and disco. And that is a Jewish lawyer by the name of Roy Cohen, okay? And a lot of people today, you don't hear much about Roy Cohen, but he's a very important figure. He was the key lawyer for McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings trying to expose communist infiltration. He's also today known as the guy that undermined the McCarthy hearings, I believe on purpose, to discredit Senator McCarthy and to protect the Jews from the communist movement who had infiltrated. And he was also the point man secretly for Eisenhower, another Jew, during that time, because the information was reaching all the way up to the Eisenhower administration of Jewish infiltration using communism. And they actually used a homosexual incident by a guy in the military named Schein, okay? And that actually discredited McCarthy and discredited the whole hearings he did on communist infiltration. Well, why did I bring that up? Because Roy Cohen was actually the lawyer for Steve Rubell, and he also worked for many of the record companies who put out disco records beginning in 74. Steve Rubell was the guy that created Studio 54, the disco dance club in New York City. And Roy Cohn became his personal lawyer.
Unbelievable.
Okay?
I'm totally unaware of that.
Yes. Roy Cohn became his personal lawyer. Now, they started Studio 54 later on. But that connection is very interesting, because what basically happened here was they used the media, then began using Studio 54 not only as a dance club, but it became more than a dance club. It became a honeypot pre-internet. I want people to think about this, to actually set up and destroy politicians who were not on board with the Jewish program. And let me give you an example of this. They used it to promote records, gay music, village people, directly from Studio 54. Sylvester, a transvestite artist, directly out of Studio 54. Also, they used it to promote Michael Jackson's solo records after the Jackson 5, as we know now, a pedophile, all right? But also, they also used Studio 54 because they allowed the drugs in there, and they also used Studio 54 to set up one of Jimmy Carter's, his chief of staff, Hamilton Jordan. He did some cocaine in the bathroom, and that became a massive scandal, which led to the rearranging of the Carter administration, where all of the local Georgia people were kicked out of the cabinet, and Council on Foreign Relations members and Zbigniew Brzezinski and others were brought in. And that then connects directly to the Chicago School and Obama today, with Zbigniew Brzezinski being the mentor and really the power behind Obama.
Wow. Yeah, I knew he was pretty busy back in the 70s, but yeah, this is news to me, man. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this was, and this connects directly to one of our favorite topics here we've talked about on other shows, Raw, Robert Anton Wilson.
Aha.
Why is that? Because Robert Anton Wilson, there were basically two magazines that became the most popular magazines from the counterculture, and that was Rolling Stone magazine, right?
Yep, yep.
Which its star was Hunter S. Thompson, who
yes.
wrote the Hell's Angels book. And its other star was from Playboy, was actually Robert Anton Wilson, who was the main editor for Playboy magazine.
Yes, he was, yeah.
Well, why is that important? Playboy magazine was credited with putting Jimmy Carter in power. Okay?
Hmm.
And Roy Cohn actually had some legal connections to Playboy magazine as well, going back to Studio 54. And what's interesting about that is that it was the Playboy article about Jimmy Carter that actually made him attractive and popular to most of the country in the 70s, okay, and put him in office. And we also see, I believe it was the Playboy magazine article of the cocaine scandal, or it might have been Rolling Stone, that was then using Studio 54 as a honeypot to then make sure that none of the low guys in the Carter administration were allowed to have power in his administration. And we see why that's important today, because Jimmy Carter, love him or hate him, he is basically more standing up against the Jewish criminality in the Middle East than any other former president today.
Wow.
Okay.
Just, yeah, go ahead.
So, you know, I feel this is pretty interesting how this connects. And that brings us to Raw, Robert Anton Wilson, okay, who came out with the peak of Studio 54 was the year of 1976, 77, and it really became very popular. And 77 was the year the Illuminatus Observer was released. Okay?
Okay.
Here we see again, the reason I find that interesting, because again, trying to control the debate of the esoteric concepts that began to emerge hardcore during that decade, and trying to, I believe, keep them in the box so that never could really bring forth fruit to really bring out a true revolution against the church and state, the theocracy that we actually live under in this country. And he actually brought that out in 77. I find that very interesting. 76.
Mm-hmm. That, the Illuminatus Observer, you said?
Yes.
That is the, you said a magazine he had?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, and it's funny, too, that that's the case, because if you read, that's the Illuminatus trilogy.
Yes, the Illuminatus trilogy. Yes, yes.
Right.
Yes.
In the beginning of that, it's surrounding this sort of like tongue-in-cheek detective story about like a terrorist bombing of the offices for a like a conspiracy theory magazine, and you know the story was taking place in the 60s or 70s. I forget, but that's really interesting. So yeah, he was. A lot of those authors like to put in their their personal experience. And it was also Robert Shea, who is apparently a co-author. I don't know who that guy really is, but he wrote that book, those books with Raw.
Right.
And I don't know what else to say.
And we also see in 1978, I believe, Robert Anton Wilson also received his PhD in psychology.
Yes. Yes, he did. He was there with, we brought this up too on the other show, he was there with Richard Alpert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, or yeah, okay. And one of Tim Leary, he was a cohort of his, and in fact, all the way up into the 90s, Raw, when Raw was still around, he actually had an appearance on the Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect show, talking about the recently departed Timothy Leary.
Mm-hmm.
So they keep that relationship going, that narrative, that life and symbolism of Leary alive. With Robert Anton Wilson, talks about him all the time. I mean, you watch these talks or lectures he did in the 80s and 90s, like he would just constantly reference him, and they were all, he wouldn't like gush over him or anything. He had his own style. So, I mean, it wasn't like that, but I mean, that's besides the point. I mean, what they were doing with the Robert Anton Wilson's activities, it's just amazing with the fact that he was libertarian. He was part of the founding of the Libertarian Party or something like that. I forget.
Actually,
I hate to get off topic, but,
This is still on topic because the Libertarian Party began to really gain momentum and support in the 70s, okay, in its early state. Remember Ron Paul, it was the grassroots construction of the Libertarian Party in the 70s under people like Robert Anton Wilson and Carrie Thornley, who was was mentioned last night in Dana's show with Robert Taylor. Great interview there, by the way.
Yeah.
Carrie Thornley was mentioned. Carrie Thornley, he actually lived in Atlanta for a while. Carrie Thornley was actually questioned in the Kennedy assassination as being a possible double for Lee Harvey Oswald, okay? Which is pretty interesting. He actually was one of the founders of the Libertarian Party as well, okay? Mm-hmm. And he was directly, he was a good friend of Robert Anton Wilson, and actually it was Carrie Thornley who later became paranoid when he moved to Little Five Points in Atlanta, in the early 80s, who accused Robert Anton Wilson of being a CIA handler and a CIA psychologist programmer and disinformation expert, which I find very, very interesting. He was in fear for his life. He also was a big-time drug addict, so you never know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but it's still rather interesting. And I was, but that show last night that Dana did actually brought up some interesting points. The Minutemen and these right-wing groups were on the rise at the same time all these other multicultural left-wing groups were on the rise, okay?
Right, yeah.
And so it is clear that there was a battle here to control the minds of those that were breaking out from the mainstream. And even some that might have started out in the Jewish-controlled communist counterculture might have eventually found their way to, stuff like the Minutemen, stuff like Revillo P. Oliver, stuff like, and started becoming more right-wing as they saw a conspiracy. And we know the Jewish conspiracy began to be on the rise in the 70s. And as someone just posted in the chat, very interesting, Robert Anton Wilson, he came up with this whole kind of concept of being an agnostic on everything. And he used to make fun of conspiracy theories, saying that it was all kind of bunk, okay? And one of the conspiracy theories that he said was the most ridiculous was the Zionist-occupied government conspiracy theory, okay?
Right.
And so here we see the dismantling and the undermining of conspiracies through Raw, and then also using the Illuminatus stuff that he wrote to kind of derail any real occult or esoteric search to lead you in the wrong direction once again.
Right.
Once again.
This gets brought up again with not just Alex Jones, although like he does it in a different way. Like he was different insofar as glorifying the founding fathers, whereas not necessarily Raw would be doing this, the following, you know, denigrating them, saying they're these religious Christian nuts or they were conspirators trying to, you know, control the world or something. You know, I mean, it's telling that these type of operations, these intellectual operations to screw with the minds of people who would be digging for this information, because Illuminatus wasn't written for everybody. And I know I hand that book to anybody. It's not gonna tickle a fancy of most of them, because I mean it's not a hard read, but the references are extremely esoteric. And even for me, and I thought like I knew a lot, but he had all these like strange historical characters in there. And again, with the truth movement, it gets repeated. Their operation gets repeated again, and it's built in a way to, well, in Raw's case, it was built in a way to be packaged towards intellectual type people who you know, wouldn't consider themselves hippies or anything. They were people who probably would be listening to Nektar and Amandul and mm-hmm. you know, in Caravan or something, you know, something like that. And you know, they packaged the propaganda towards the people they're trying to who they know can possibly make a change, culturally or intellectually at the least. So yeah, this is what they do, and look at the truth movement. What did that do? It did the very same thing. It but it's, again, different in its framing. And the Alex Jones branch of it is the conservative camp, you know, the Christian, moral, patriotic, anti-Nazi,
right? Antifa. It's the Antifa of America, Alex Jones.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So yeah, I mean, it's just amazing that this stuff gets repeated and over again, but the extent that it was done is incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And I think David in Texas in the chat room mentioned that 77 was also the year that the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane went down.
Mm-hmm.
And 77. Oh, one more thing with Roy Cohen in Studio 54 and Disco. I want to mention before we move on to the second hour here, I'm going to play a song. We're going to take a little break at the top of the hour here in just a second. But I wanted to mention that Roy Cohen was also on the board of directors of the John Birch Society and one of the movers of West Island's books, which later became American Opinion Book Services. So here you see Roy Cohen, the Jewish lawyer, anti-communist, but at the same time, communist.
Right.
Here you see the typical Jewish duality of putting his eggs in many baskets and being a very important behind-the-scenes guy, whether it be the point man for McCarthy, who McCarthy trusted, who later undermined McCarthy to protect the communist Jews in the blacklist hearings, or whether it was to protect Studio 54 for the ability to push their multicultural programming in the 70s, or whether it was to protect record execs within the Jewish music industry as a lawyer, or whether it was to protect right-wing false opposition in the John Birch Society. Pretty amazing when you really look at his resume. And
yeah, absolutely. Wow, to say the least, yeah.
Yeah. But 77, the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane went down, and I figure this is a good way to start the top of the hour here. We'll take a music break. But
perfect.
Lynyrd Skynyrd plane went down in 77, and 77 was also the year that the end, the last part of the 70s started to begin with 77, and Frank Cohen, Frank Collin, and the Nazis in Skokie also in 1977. We see whether it was accidental or planned, the death of a Southern band that really was bringing Southern pride through rock and roll, that was taken out of the picture for the most part.
Yep.
At the same time, the discrediting of the National Socialist once again through Frank Cohen, a.k.a. Frank Collin, and the Skokies incident with the Nazi party there. in 77, and 77 was the year that the Illuminatus was released by Anton Wilson. I find that very interesting, very important year there.
Indeed.
And with that said, let me find this here. I'm going to play some Kraftwerk here. And
all right.
This is Kraftwerk with Autobahn. We'll be right back.
Time in my life when I was down so low, a mosquito wouldn't even bite me. I lost my job, my four-wheel drive. I even got thrown out of my trailer. All because of one thing. Free basing, cocaine. That's all my life was basing. Nothing else. I was on that last lap with that checkered flag about to weigh me on into hell. But I got lucky. I got in a rehab program down there at Redstone Arsenal, down there in Alabama. And with them people helping me, well, that smoky white devil is no longer a part of my life. And I can proudly say that today, I do not freebase cocaine. Now, I'll take a drink now. I will take a drink, but I do not freebase cocaine. But, you know, I'll take a drink, and I might even smoke a little reef. You know, I like smoke. reefer. You know, it relaxes me and everything. A couple of doobies, you know, just to get you through the day and everything. But as far as basing goes, I don't do it. Now, I do some toot now. Don't get me wrong. I will do some toot, you know. And, you know, if you part and everything, somebody comes up and give it to you, it's impolite not to take it there. So me and my girlfriend, Sally, we, you know, we party, man. I'll tell you, we do party. So, you know, I will do some toot. We do, you know, on a good weekend there, we call a bunch of friends over there, we do about an 8-ball of toot there. But we don't base. I do not freebase cocaine. We'll make that clear. I don't do it. Well, I tell you what, that drinking now, I would not drink that tequila. Now, I tell you what, the last time I drank it, I got wild and everything. My girlfriend said I beat up on Sally. And, you know, when I done that, it hurt me a lot more than it does her when I'm beating the hell out of her. So I don't drink that tequila now. And I don't do any basing. I do not freebase. That's two things I don't do. It's no longer part of my life. But I tell you what, I will tequila. I admit, I do drink it about twice a year, you know. I drank some tequila, and of course, when I do drink it, Sally, you better look out, because you know I'm going to go upside that head now. Oh, but basing I don't do. I you know, I heard somewhere coffee's bad for you, that caffeine mess. I read that somewhere. So I do that speed, get back up again. Of course, you got to get ready the next day, going all day long, part of things. But as far as basing goes, I don't do that. I will not free base cocaine. I don't touch it. Unless it's my birthday, something, man, a special occasion, I'll get out that pipe and I'll base. I won't freebase cocaine if I'm behind the wheel of a car. I won't do it. If I'm driving the car, I won't do it. Unless, you know, you stopped in traffic, you know you're going to be there a while, ain't nothing on the radio, I'll pull out that pipe and I'll base. But I will not freebase cocaine if I'm in church. I will not freebase cocaine in churches, unless, you know, it's during a hymn and I don't like something. I might get out that pipe and I'll base in it. I admit it. And I won't do it during the sermon, though. I will not freebase cocaine in church during the sermon unless I've heard it before. Unless, you know, I've heard that song, I won't hear the same thing. You just won't sit there and do nothing, so I'll get out that pipe and I'll base. But I won't do it. I will not do it at the altar. I will not. I can tell you right now, I've been through that rehab, and freebasing is no longer part of my life.
This message brought to you by the Redstone Drug Rehabilitation Center, reminding you to just say nope to dope.
Yes, that was the new. I finally got a commercial sponsor for Reconstructions Live, and that was the Redstone Clinic in South Alabama. And just say nope to dope. And I figured I'd go ahead and wheel that out tonight. So we're talking about the 70s and all. I don't want anybody to have a flashback who might be listening and get nerves to do something they would regret in the morning. Don't want to deplete your serotonin levels. Don't want to stay up too late and, you know, wake up in the morning, you know, listening to Led Zeppelin 4 on repeat. Okay? What did that happen?
With Wizard of Oz playing on your DVD player. Your VHS player, whatever the hell you use.
Okay, like, dude, like, on the third roar of the lion on Wizard of Oz, you play Dark Side of the Moon, and, like, dude, it's
right,
like,
on, man.
The whole fucking movie is synchronized, like, to, like, the Wizard of Oz, dude.
Right on, man. So right, man.
Yes, welcome back.
we were talking about something a little depressing, the crash in 77, the plane crash. At least Ronnie Van Zant was dead. What was it, the guitarist? One of the guitarists died as well?
Yeah, something like that. I know that I saw the new Lynyrd Skynyrd, they suck. You know, they're like, we no longer have the Confederate flag flying in our concerts. We just have, opening up for Lynyrd Skynyrd is, you know, fucking some Jewish band.
Eminem.
Yeah, Eminem's going to do a rap song to, oh, that's already occurred. That was, what's the guy from Rebel Without a Cause?
Or James Dean?
No, that rapper from Michigan, that Kid Rock.
Okay.
Devil without a God. He already did a terrible, terrible loop of Sweet Home Alabama.
Oh, yeah, it was bad.
Oh, God.
Where was I? I was at the freaking Applebee's or something at like 1 in the morning, and I was playing. This is the first time I heard it. I was like, what is this atrocious crap? What is this? I know I've heard Sweet Home Alabama a million times already, so I knew what the real thing sounded like, but, I mean, he just, like, took it and... Yeah, it was just awful. I can't imagine what the Southern people think of it. I mean, but yeah, that was pretty atrocious. Kid Rock was something else when I was growing up. He wasn't like taking on this country stuff and becoming that. But you know, enough about Kid Rock.
Enough about that shit.
Yeah.
So we left off with 77. Now, this is important.
Right.
It was the year we saw the beginning of the 70s. We saw the demonization, wanting to dismantle the counterculture because many countercultural people were waking up and becoming more into the esoteric, more into European spiritualism, awakening to more of the backlash toward the... If you're going to San Francisco, carry flowers in your hand kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they had to make sure they controlled that and to kill it, destroy it. We saw the rise of the Minutemen. We saw the rise of right-wing groups beginning in the 70s as well, hardcore. And I would tell people to listen to Dana's show last night. I thought that was interesting with Robert Taylor on there.
Yeah.
And I think that was a lot of the reasoning why they wanted to demonize using the show trial of the Manson family hearings. And then in 77, we see when the Nazis came to Skokie with Frank Cohen, the child molester, communist, posing as a national socialist in Skokie, Illinois in 1977. Big year there. So here we see the theme continuing, okay? The theme continuing, which is very interesting.
Indeed. Yeah, again, I mean, 77 was an important year musically as well. But yeah, we have these events that they let happen, or they create at the least let happen. They obviously had their hand in Skokie because it's Skokie, so not much research you have to really do on that one. I mean, I don't take those things very seriously. I mean, that is the supposed political opposition to Jews and Skokie. I mean, come on, they want these things to happen, so they have an excuse. So look at the history we have. Back in the 70s, there was all these evil Nazis, and they were, you know, it's a joke.
Yeah. And also, as people were talking in the chat during the break there, 76, 77, Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you had the Skokie thing happening. The demonization of this mindset by the Jewish media. You had Star Wars, which was another way of demonizing and rewriting World War II history through a science fiction movie.
Frank Cohen here, you need to join the dark side.
Now, I wonder if Frank Cohen, the Jew Nazi in Skokie, I wonder if he was listening to Michael Jackson records. Mainly Michael Jackson's first solo record in 77, Off the Wall. I wonder if Frank Cohen might have partied with Michael Jackson and drank some Jesus juice with some little young Nazi boys there.
Yeah, Bubbles was probably there too, you know, hopping around and serving drinks. And, you know, it was probably a big circus. They love circuses, and they love putting on a show and screwing with the minds of children, and at the very least. These are the most diabolical, disgusting creatures we've ever had to deal with, and yet they were at the reins of power back then. Okay? They had the music world pretty much under their control, and at least their influence. We were already going over that before, but the fact that Star Wars came out, that was a big thing. That was that was, I don't know if it was filmed in England now, but it was, there was a lot of English actors in it. A lot of, the whole cast with the A New Hope, the first film, pretty much the whole cast was unknown, except for Alec Guinness, I believe, who played Obi-Wan Kenobi. And, yeah, that's, oh, and Obi-Wan Kenobi, the old wizened mage. Yeah, that name doesn't sound Jewish at all. and the fact that he lives in, he's a good guy. He's the old wizened good guy, and he teaches the young blonde-haired white man, white kid. All he needs to know to fight the evil dark side. Oh, and the dark side has stormtroopers, right? And they're the Empire, and they have all these gray uniforms, and they're very organized and powerful. And Star Wars, I can't even begin to explain how Star Wars, at least in my opinion, that Star Wars is the piece of science fiction or fantasy that really kicked off and solidified psychologically completely the taboo of an Imperium, the Empire, a strong force, because forevermore, cue the Imperial March, because you know we're right. I mean, it was perfect. It was perfect on what was it, two round tables ago. You guys played that. I mean, it was just to mimic what Alex Jones did on his show for a while as his intro. Because yeah, that's it. Just we're up against the Empire here. You know, it solidified that narrative forever, in my opinion, up until a point where perhaps we can shed it off, but. Yeah, Star Wars got its claws into the American public, because even back then, as far as I know, people were utterly obsessed with Star. I mean, the merchandise, the later on it would have limitless almost examples of how it was. I mean, what am I trying to say here? Limitless ways in which other pieces of media would bring up Star Wars or reference Star Wars all the time. It's like, it goes so far as, you know how people call you a grammar Nazi or something like that, along the lines like that. Well, if you're doing something bad or it's like, oh, you're going to the dark side or something like that. It always goes back to fucking Star Wars. Like, it's just, And when I learned that was a Jewish creation, I tried to get away from my lexicon, away from my thoughts as possible. I want to bring up the merchandise again because, yeah, this it's all over the airwaves. People are obsessed with it. It has its own fan base, yes, but even the people who aren't necessarily fans of Star Wars know about it and know its basic lore. And, dark side, light side, blah, blah, blah. The good guy is a little Jewish goblin who lives in a swamp.
Yeah.
And
it's Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz is Yoda, who teaches Luke Skywalker how to play with himself, his lightsaber. It's a total joke. And, I have to say, being alive in the 70s as a kid, that movie, my dad took me to see that probably 8-9 times in the theater,
right,
when it came out. I had the Star Wars vinyl album of all the music on it.
Wow.
I still have the figurines boxed up. That was huge. And if you were a kid, if you were a child during that time, I was 6-7 years old.
It was perfect for your age group. There you go. I don't know about the rating system back then, but they were probably more relaxed back then. I mean, what was it? G, I guess, right? Was it PG? They want the younger kids who can form sentences, make demands of their parents, to bring them to these movies and get them the merchandise for Christmas and make it the child's not only source of thought, but one of the center ones, you know, wanting to be the hero in the movie, and you know, wanting to fight an evil like found in the movie, you know, and mimic it with the merchandise. But go on, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying, and yeah, that's what they did. But again, this is where I think we see a orchestrated theme taking place throughout this decade, even more so than in the 60s, Sig, as we see the Skokie situation taking place. We see Star Wars coming out all at the same time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it is clear when you look at Spielberg's contributions to the Hala hoax story, you know, I mean, is
oh yeah,
Schindler's List, who was connected to Star Wars there, and yep. We see the narrative coming out with Star Wars at the same time. Frank Cohen was again in the 70s making right wing movements look like they were, you know, insane and crazy with the help of the Jewish media. And we see that same narrative, as you mentioned just now, connecting to the modern day truth movement, the roots there, to Alex Jones. So we see, you know, this was a very important year, a very important year. And there was also one other event taking place in 77. The People's Temple of the Reverend Jim Jones began to gain momentum. They actually started building the village there in 75, 76 in South America, in Guyana, with the help of the military there, I might add. It is clear that the Reverend Jim Jones had communist Jewish Bolshevik money pumped into his church from the very beginning. He was a communist Jewish agent. You talk about racial liberation theology. That was coming on the scene. I believe that was a testing ground for Obama, okay, that type of rhetoric. But we see 77, 78 now, the Guyana tragedy with the Reverend Jim Jones.
Right.
And let me just, I have something here. It's real short. I want people to hear what liberation theology and cultural racial Marxism sounds like when everybody is living in a communist Jewish commune in South America. Let me show you the dark side, the true side of this sickness, this disease called Bolshevism. Listen to the Reverend Jim Jones here just a couple days before he was killed.
I'm sick and tired of when you are here under the damn earphone, you don't listen. Don't fuck with me next time. Do I make myself clear? Don't fuck with me next time. Don't any analyst take it upon yourself to laugh and you little cheery things amongst yourself. Because I don't give a shit that you listen to me. You dumb motherfucker. I only want you to grow up and care like I care. And you dumb idiots that won't listen when you have the opportunity. Damn you. Damn you. Damn you.
Yes. So there you go. That was the Reverend Jim Jones from the
sounded
People's.
Like,
yeah.
Sounded like a communist to me.
Sounds like John Hagee. I bet that's John Hagee. If we start to rise up here at Renegade, folks, I have John Hagee here. He can't believe that white nationalism is on the rise. Oh my God, John Hagee, what do you think about the rise of white nationalism?
I'm sick and tired of when you are here under the damn earphone, you don't listen. Don't fuck with me next time. Do I make myself clear? Don't fuck with me next time. Don't any analyst take it upon yourself to laugh and you little cheery things amongst yourself. Because I don't give a shit that you listen to me. You dumb motherfucker. I only want you to grow up and care like I care. And you dumb idiots that won't listen when you have the opportunity. Damn you. Damn you. Damn you.
Wow.
Here you go, folks.
God has truly blessed him with
yes.
A light heart, yes.
That was actually, we have the Black Pope time machine in the future. That was John Hagee responding to the destruction of Israel.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
amazing technology here at Renegade Broadcasting.
We have, I mean, Nazi paperclip technology that allows us to hear this. I mean, it is
I'm sick and tired of when you are here under the damn earphone, you don't listen. Don't fuck with me next time. Do I mean...
Wow.
But then we see.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Zig. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there you see. I mean, that basically was the multicultural program taking to its dark conclusion there.
Yeah.
That was the testing ground of modern America that we live in today.
Yeah. And it's a scary thing to say. I mean, most people in this country wouldn't even begin to be able to understand that. But, yeah, it's condensed in such a short time. Obama had decades and decades and decades of societal programming within the country to prepare it for his ascendance, his messiah-like ascension to power. Even if he wasn't president, he would still have some sort of niche in the culture as the Michelinger that could, the little Michelinger that almost could. And the 70s had a huge part in preparing this country, this world. I mean, 70s American culture was envied throughout the world. You know, you had going back to the disco stuff and the American rock.
Yeah.
That was found throughout the world. I mean, even in Iran, you know, through Germany, France, Italy, you know, they all loved it. So America had sort of this cultural hegemony over everything else at the time. And, well, when you look at, like, the Jim Jones thing, that's, like, that doesn't get much airtime on the infomercials talking about here buy the new 70s CDs and, like, remember the 70s CDs. And they don't talk about those things. They talk about the well-made-up, well-dressed musicians that they approved of. And, you know, that was it. I mean, then they get these creeps that they also approve of, but they never talk about unless they have to, like on a special report on the Hitler Channel, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. Unbelievable occurrences back in the 70s, and you're right. That's what it was. It was a testing ground.
And it was... go ahead. I'm sorry, dude.
That's it. No.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, what's interesting about this is at the same time, we saw the this end of the multicultural nightmare. We see it come to its end. And I believe, by the way, this is the what you hear there in Jim Jones's voice is going to be what you're going to hear when this multicultural program comes collapsing down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the same scenario. I mean, there's no difference between how they marketed Obama and how they marketed Jim Jones. It's just that they had to have a white guy from Indianapolis then going to San Francisco to run that operation directly funded by Jewish Bolsheviks. Now they feel comfortable. They can actually have a black guy telling black people to drink Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And
they love that. They love that.
And Antifa white people to drink Kool-Aid.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we can chug that Kool-Aid. Yes, we can. Rahm Emanuel, go pour me some Kool-Aid. Yes, we can pour the Kool-Aid, and we will drink the Kool-Aid. Rahm Emanuel, is that Kool-Aid ready yet?
Oh, it's ready. Oh, it's getting ready.
Hey, save me a glass of the grape drink in the for the bathhouse in Chicago. Just don't put any cyanide in there, Rahm.
I was saving that last batch for the ballet meeting. I was oh.
I knew you were excited about Baryshnikov. It's disgusting.
I mean, even the so-called leftists or not necessarily the hardcore hippie communists, but liberals, you know, back in the 70s, if we told them, if we were able to tell them what would unfold and what would happen in the 2008 presidential election, they wouldn't believe us. And even after that, I mean, 2012, mm-hmm. like what already would happen with the Obama administration, they would not even, there's no way they would believe us. None. No way. And that's the liberals back then, you know? Like, not only would they be aghast by it ideologically, they would be just too surprised and wouldn't understand how it would be coming, but, oh, they were preparing for it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah. It's but here's something that I want to get into now before I get to the next part here of the 70s is, you know, in 77 also was the beginning of the punk rock movement, actually. 76, 77, we see the Sex Pistols emerging,
mm-hmm.
which I want to get into here because that's also interesting. Because we see, once again, the common theme of there, Sid Vicious wearing the swastika shirts, again, pushing the anarchy and trying to combine anarchy with National Socialism,
right.
I think, was also part of the discrediting going back to Germany again, because there was far from anarchy. That was order and prosperity. It was not anarchy.
Right.
And but I still love their music. But that band was controlled by Malcolm McLaren, a British Jew, who actually ran a sex S&M shop in the King's Road down there in the Piccadilly Circus in England, which is pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And so here we see once again the orchestration around the same time. You have the Star Wars movie backing up the Holocaust story, the revisionist history of World War II.
Yeah.
Going into real history, we see the Manson Family Show trials. We see Frank Collins, Skokie, a Nazi party. And we see punk rock emerging and promoting swastikas once again in a way that might seem cool to the younger crowd, but it discredits it and scares away the middle class.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point because that's what this all has been about. Even to this day, scaring the middle class and confusing them and supplying them also with the supposed answers, Alex Jones.
right.
I mean, how many middle-class people, still Christian, were, I'm upset about the government. I need to find the answers. Oh, Infowars.com has all the answers for me, you know. And it's still Christian-friendly, and it's still anti-Nazi. So I'm psychologically satisfied. And that's always what it's been about, either pissing off and or scaring the middle class back in the 70s with the punk people, satiating them and supplying them again with the supposed answers, the kosher answers, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
yeah.
it's just more of that. And the 70s was the maybe not the first time they did stuff like that, but some of the best examples of it, and something we can all learn from, and perhaps even discuss it with people you know who lived through all this stuff, and they knew their parents were reviled by it, and they were too, if they're middle class, you know, say. It doesn't matter, but, I mean, you know, it's just a time period where all this happened. They like to think that the 60s was the point in which the culture kind of split. That may be true, but there were all these answers to that split, and then some, with the 70s, with the punks, yeah. So.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, you look, I was a huge fan of punk rock. I was a huge fan of the Sex Pistols, huge fan of Minor Threat, huge fan of Dead Kennedys, huge fan of Black Flag.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 80s, I was at the age where I was skateboarding and listening to that stuff, and it was great stuff, and it was still 10 times better than any of that hippie shit that came out. But what they did was they you know, it's kind of like what's happening now. They knew there was this reaction arising, on the rise, just like they see now of nationalism, and it was all about quarantining, containing, and controlling it, and keeping it in the box as much as they could.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. And so they used the symbolism, going back to NSDAP parties, swastika symbolism and all that, to mix it in with the Jewish record exec propaganda to, you know, keep the movement in the Jew box, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it brilliantly. But ultimately, and this is the interesting thing I want to crescendo to here now, Sig, is Dana posted in a comment section here on Renegade on one of the shows that remember the backlash against disco when they burned all the disco records in Kaminsky Park?
Mm-hmm.
And they had that huge movement where thousands of fans rushed to the baseball field during a White Sox game and burnt their disco albums and had fireworks and exploded and had like a riot on the field, and it was called the Death of Disco Revolt.
Yeah, I vaguely know about that whole event, but yeah.
Okay, well, here's what I found interesting. And think about this for a second. The consolidation of the program began really, the crescendo of it in the 60s, began at the 68 convention with Abby Hoffman in Chicago and the consolidation of the Chicago School and Jewish Power. We see the ending of their first creation at the disco demolition in Chicago.
Right.
In Kaminsky Park, where it began, it ended almost 10 years later, okay? At a White Sox game, okay? And what's the symbology of rushing the field? Baseball was considered then to be what? America's pastime, right?
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And they then moved on to a different program, a new program that ushered in the Reagan era in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to play this real quick. This is the sound of what the disco demolition sound like in our Black Pope flashback time machine.
Do with themselves and how to have a good time. They follow someone who's a jerk. Well, that's the situation here. A lot of followers and a lot of kids drinking down in the stands. There are a lot of happy kids out there. I don't mean happy in the modern sense, but pleasant kids enjoying themselves, showing off a little bit. But the thing you have to consider now, Jim, is whether they can keep this crowd in control.
You know, they're trying to announce it over a loudspeaker, but nobody can hear over the loud. There are now, I say, 10,000 people on that field, Bill, without any question. Many are grouped around home plate, more around the mound, and they are just letting out.
So there you go. And I might use that. That could, you know what, that could be a, that could be the sound for the Adam Kokesh Open Carry March.
Saddest day in baseball.
Saddest day in Washington. I mean, these guys follow a kosher jerk. Open carrying on the field. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that'd be great. I guess,
you see my point here, though.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean,
strange event.
And again, Chicago.
Yes.
This cannot be overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as I piece my Chicago studies, the more I uncover is just, it blows my mind, man.
Mm-hmm.
When you really look back, you can definitely see the cultural Marxism trend creating machines. They knew that disco sales were down, that they saw the white rage, the return of the white male.
Yep.
And they had to harness that anger. And guess what? After that disco demolition, Studio 54 then went under. Steve Rubell, the Jew there, was then sent to jail for a period of time for tax evasion. It then changed hands. He then stayed on the, as the board of directors of Studio 54. But here's what's interesting. Studio 54 became a heavy metal punk rock venue in the early 80s. And
I was not aware of that. Wait,
yes.
What?
Slayer actually performed there as one of the bands in the underground part of Studio 54 for the Revenge Against Disco. The first band to play on the Studio 54 set, are you ready for this? Kiss. Chaim Weitz, a.k.a. Gene Simmons.
Right.
From the Jew Boy Band, the White Shoe Boy Band. The White Shoe Boys Band.
Yeah.
Kikes and Satan's Service. actually was the first metal, first rock band to play at Studio 54 post-disco. So there you see.
Unbelievable.
Keeping it kosher in the kitchen, baby.
Yeah. Wow. I was not aware of the whole Studio 54 transforming, and yet that goes to show you that's what they do. They change with the times, and perhaps they weren't counting on whites waking up in such a way, but maybe they were expecting it. I'm not sure, but it's incredible. Like they have their little escape plans, and you know, looking at today's world, maybe it hasn't really worked in their favors because you know, we're seeing past all that. And just something I want to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
It's off topic as per music, but in 78, this dirty Jewish animator, director named Ralph Bakshi, in 78, he came out with the strangely animated version of Lord of the Rings. And
yes,
he was also responsible for this this creepy and disgusting cartoon film. I don't know when this one came out, but it was called Fritz the Cat. He was responsible for that and other things. And and Lord of the Rings has that sort of niche within the white mind, within white lore, as not necessarily healing white people of their anger and sort of having an outlet for it. That's more like the music scene. That's the music's job, or the gangs or whatever that they also probably create. But that's besides the point. But Lord of the Rings, it's there to satiate the white people's minds and wants for their own lore to be expressed, and not someone else's, not a biblical lore. You know, it's almost exclusively white. I mean, so you have Jews like Ralph Bakshi, taking that and expressing it, and you know, putting it into animation, and having all these pretty famous people were in it, like John Hurt. So yeah, that's what they do, and it was distributed by Warner Brothers currently, and yeah, that's just something I wanted to bring up. I don't know.
One of my favorite animations there as a kid, and let me do my little impersonation here. Oh, my precious. My precious, where's the ring? You lost it, my precious. My precious. Here's a riddle for you to find the ring, my precious. By the way, I mentioned before, and it's true, that when I went to Brave New Books, it was a bunch of Jews talking about Lord of the Rings when I was checking out.
Yeah, I remember that.
Trying to purchase a Jack Blood t-shirt. Christ almighty.
Yeah.
But, you know, going back to the Kiss thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, this is something I overlooked. They were the first rock band to play at Studio 54 after the Disco Rebellion. Actually, Ted Nugent benefited from that as well. He's big in the pockets of the GOP these days.
Right.
But also, Kiss was, they brought Kiss out with Dress to Kill in 72, 73, when Zeppelin and Black Sabbath were gaining momentum, and also the German rock bands were gaining momentum, and the backlash against the hippie music, the first acid rock metal days, and Kiss was totally the commercialization of the Black Sabbath genre. And again, here we see, you know, the Jewish control over that band, Gene Simmons, who stayed to be a rabbi, by the way.
Yeah, I've heard that, yeah.
Yes. So, makes total sense.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And I just from personal experience, I never understood any fascination. And again, I grew up throughout the 90s. And growing up, I would see these old idiots walking around with Kiss shirts. I'm like, you know, Mom, Dad, what the hell is Kiss? Like, and they're like, oh, it's like they, and they weren't into it either. They weren't into disco either, but not Kiss either too. So they would lazily explain it to me. I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds pretty shitty. Like, and I heard the music was really shitty, and I never understood the fascination with it. Never. I don't. And they still have ridiculously rabid fans. I mean, unbelievable.
I hate to say I was a member of the Kiss Army.
Yeah, and
had the Kiss.
Robella P. Oliver was the founding member of the John Perch Society. It's okay.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
I feel so dirty. I feel like the crying game.
The crying game?
But, now, here's what's interesting also, to kind of close the show out here, is that David in Texas, and I have a special song I want to play for you, Siegfried.
Oh, sure.
At the end of the show here, which will be the 70s crescendo of your classical music that you love so well.
And all right.
But let me say this. You know, David in Texas made a great point in the chat room. You know, Saturday Night Fever. With John Travolta.
Yes.
You know, really was the big thing there. You know, basically inducting strong Italian males into the gay multicultural agenda in disco. In my opinion, that was the purpose of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out that Travolta likes to hang out in Vegas bathhouses these days. no coincidence there. But also, after the disco demolition took place in Chicago, by the way, where the program began and ended, Urban Cowboy then came out, as David in Texas mentioned. And then we begin to see the using country music, the taking over of country music and turning that into top 40 music with new country in the 80s. And Urban Cowboy really signified the beginning of that cultural shift. With the Jewish control over country music completely, just as they used Travolta and Saturday Night Fever to do the trend for the disco in Studio 54 in the 70s.
Now, wait a second, Mike. Was Urban, and I didn't see this one. Urban Cowboy is the film with Dustin Hoffman in it, right?
No, no, no. John Travolta.
Oh, I'm sorry, Deborah Winger. Oh.
Okay.
I'm thinking, and like, okay, yeah, yeah.
Deborah Winger, and that could be a possible association to the wimpy-ass gay rock band Winger. I'm just kidding around. they're all crisis actors. But no, Urban Cowboy, John Travolta, all of a sudden he went from, yo, hey, I'm Tony Manero. I'm the Italian guy that likes to disco dance at gay clubs. And now all of a sudden he's Urban Cowboy,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And he's hanging out. He's an Italian guy hanging out in Texas as a cowboy riding the bull.
Right.
And, you know, and all this kind of crap. Yes, Winger is a Jewess. Dave in Texas, once again, thanks there. It all connects. And we see the shift taking place. They always know when to create the trends and when to dump a program and to create a new one through their cultural Marxism through their media outlets. And this is why I felt like this show was so important to do, man.
I agree. I'm very glad that you had me today. Despite the fact that I was born way after the 70s, and I appreciate it. Mike, well done as usual.
Well, I mean, I have you on because, you know, as you are a music connoisseur in whether it be rock, classical, you're a musician yourself, and I found that it doesn't matter what generation you're from or what decade you were born, you know, I found that even though you weren't from that generation, you know more about many of the bands from that generation than the people that were living, because they were listening to Air Supply and ELO.
Oh, God. Throw up.
And, but
Pretzel Logic.
Oh, Steely Dan. Named after a dildo from a movie there.
So bad that George Carlin would make fun of people who listen to Steely Dan, yeah.
I actually saw Steely Dan twice, live.
Oh, Kiss Army, Steely Dan, concert tickets. When is it going to end with you, Mike?
Happy about the crying game. I feel like getting in the shower and just with a loofah and... Wait a minute. Loofah? Loofwaffa? Loofawaffa? Okay, never mind. Getting into Edge of Range territory here. But, I figure we would end the show here, close it out with, let me find this here, because I think this is my dedication to the multicultural gay 70s with Siegfried. And folks, be sure to catch Ragnarok Now right here on the one and only Renegade Broadcasting and all the great shows here at Renegade Broadcasting. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to end the show with this. Siegfried, thanks for coming on, and we'll do the 80s show soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thanks for listening, everybody.
All right, man. Check this out. Dedicated to Siegfried.